This is Julie Christie interviewing Tony Farrell, the Director of City Strategy with Lake Macquarie City Council, about the storms of June 8 to 11, 2007.
Tony Farrell, Director of City Strategy. Okay, so what happened with me? I was actually in Sydney on the 8th, so I missed out on most of the excitement with the rain and the grounding of the Pashabalka. I was in Sydney at a meeting with the Department of Planning. I was with some other staff, and we thought, being a Friday before the long weekend, we didn't really want to face the traffic coming home after our meeting. So we decided we would go to the football, and we went to the football at Telstra Stadium and watched Souths beat Penrith, which was fine because I'm a South supporter. And then had to face the journey home, realising by then that there'd been some very bad rain, and that there were stories of the roads potentially being cut. Including by that time news of the Pacific Highway tragedy with the family lost. I had Sharon Pope and Brian Gibson, a couple of our planning staff, with me. We tried to get home via Wobber Road, turning off at Palmer's Road at a Wobber, and got turned back there by the Rural Fire Service. Came further north and was able to get through on George Booth Drive, although by then we started seeing all these cars parked in funny locations next to the main roads, and sort of it took us a little while to put two and two together and realise that these, because the water had dissipated, that these cars had been flooded and washed into strange locations and been abandoned because people were trying to flee for their lives. So we got Sharon back to the offices here, and she was able to go home. She lives at Georgetown, and she's got an interesting story to tell. She lives next to a drainage channel and had her dog locked in the backyard for the day. And when she got home, the only piece of her backyard above water level was the top step at the back door, and that's where the dog was sitting, of course, and no doubt wasn't very impressed about being cooped up there all day. Brian lives at Alibana, and I followed Brian out to the Esplanade via Medcalf Street and King Street, because the Esplanade was closed past the roundabout at Medcalf Street. Anyway, he got through eventually, once again dodging lots of cars parked particularly around the Hillsborough Road and Macquarie Road roundabout. Anyway, I got home quite safely, quite easily at Lakelands. That night, of course, we then had the big winds, and that's probably when most of the damage to buildings and structures in Lake Macquarie occurred. I was lucky enough at home, didn't really suffer very much damage. It took me a couple of hours in the morning to clean it up. And then I came into work because it was obvious that there was going to be a lot of cleaning up to be done. We had no power in the admin building. Mark Rogers was here in the IT department. Mark, we had a program shutdown of our IT services for the long weekend. To change over into new servers and rewire the IT room. So it was just a massive job. The IT area was in chaos. There was cable hanging out of the roof. It was in pitch black. And we knew we had to try and get the customer service centre up and running as soon as we could. So I started sourcing some generators for Mark so that we could get light on in the IT room, and he could start pulling the cables through again. And we started to also think about getting our customer service centre up by contacting staff. Actually, that might have occurred a bit later in the day, I think. I then went down to the depot to see how they were travelling with outdoor staff, who would have by then no doubt been, I realised, be involved in emergency response. And found Kerry Smith and Dave Robson in the main trying to coordinate activities. There's not much I could do, but gave them a bit of moral support, I think, and told them not to worry about costs and so forth, given that there was no one else in a senior position who could come in. Brian Bell, the GM, was flooded at Chitterway Point and couldn't leave home. Colin Irvine had suffered a lot of damage at home and has a young baby, so and a pregnant wife at that time. He really needed to stay there. And Morven Cameron being down at Mooney Mooney. She had, would have had a long way to come, and by then they were discouraging people using the roads, given there were a lot of trees down. And Amanda Colby, she did actually come in on the Saturday, if I recall, and helped get a few things organised. On Saturday morning, I also went and spoke to the SES people to make sure that they were getting the support they needed from council. One issue I can recall them having was access to small plant. They were running out of things like chainsaws and so forth, and we arranged to make sure that whatever we could make available to them, they got their hands on. They were very, very busy. They were logging lots and lots of calls. They had many thousands of calls over the period of the emergency. But they didn't declare a natural disaster, mainly because it would have probably created some confusion with Newcastle Command, where a natural disaster had already been declared. And it gives the police certain powers to give direction and so forth. And by only having the natural disaster declared in Newcastle, I think helped simplify the chain of command. So Graham Clark was the, I think it was Graham, senior policeman there at the time, and didn't really need any extra assistance. Keith Stevenson was on the job as our SES coordinator and our local emergency management officer, I think is his title. By then we were mainly concerned with our own communications and our own response. So with no power on, a lot of people's phones were not functional. They'd flatten their batteries over the night. Some of the mobile phone repeater stations were down due to them also being blacked out. Our two-way network was of limited use. We had no faxes, no landlines. So in the main, we were relying on people getting occasional mobile phone coverage. We had some power in a couple of two or three power points, I think, in the Civil Oak offices where everyone was taking in turns to charge their phone. I think they had a toaster going. People were having toast for breakfast, lunch and dinner. And that went on for most of the rest of the day, trying mainly to work out whether we could get the customer service centre up and running by getting the computers functional. And I think sometime during the course of the day we did work out we could. We had generators on hand, which I borrowed off trucks that were out doing emergency works that didn't really need generators. We had a couple of our own generators. Then the electrician that was the contractor that was working in the computer room showed up with a really big generator, which was handy. So we had plenty of light. They were able to continue working. Gave us a prognosis that they'd get the customer service centre up and running within 48 hours. So then we started contacting staff. So Rhonda Skelton and Gary Brown were phoning around asking people who were on leave, of course, for the long weekend what their availability was to come in and start work in the customer service centre. There was also a lot of effort then going into working out when, making sure we didn't burn people out, making sure we got enough people here to do the job, but didn't expect all the staff to work all the time so that we could have some rotating shifts and give people some relief. There was a few issues about feeding people at different times. All the a lot of the local commercial areas have been blacked out and were continuing to be blacked out, so trying to get some meals for people at different times, we struggled a bit and eventually came good. We spent basically Saturday trying to record incoming calls and give people some comfort that we were up and running, ready, trying to get ourselves open for business. And in fact, I wrote out a press release by hand, of course, because we didn't have any computers or printers, and eventually got a fax machine going, and we broadcast it to all media saying that we were working to get our customer service centre up and running and we'll be taking calls as soon as the phones were back online and we had electricity. I think Energy Australia showed up late on Saturday afternoon as well, and were able to restore power only to the admin building late on Saturday, which it's a little bit embarrassing given all the neighbourhood houses were blacked out except for a couple that were very close to the admin building, but we're obviously getting favoured treatment, and that allowed us then to get the customer service centre up and running. We started advertising that the customer service centre was open for business and trying to direct people onto the customer service centre number rather than through our emergency answering service, mostly because they were overwhelmed, and then even once they did take calls, they couldn't then transfer the information onto us because their faxes were down and phones were problematic. So even if they did take an emergency call, it just sort of got stuck there with them, and we weren't really in a position to respond. So we got people in, got the customer service centre up and running. I think the first call we received was from a lady who'd lost her wheel off her wheelie bin and was asking for someone to come out and repair that for her. But it quickly, obviously, turned into more serious situations for people. Lots of tree and drainage issues, damage to roads and other community infrastructure. We focused initially on trying to clear driveways so that people could get access to their premises and get out of their premises. People were, needed to be able to get out and drive around and, buy ice and go and see if there was anything left at the camping stores to get light into their houses. Lots and lots of people were blacked out. We're also conscious of trying to be as normal as possible by the following Tuesday morning, when people would be trying to get back to work after, in most cases, 3 days without electricity. I think we did a pretty good job of that. I think all in all, there were very few people who weren't quickly able to get access to their premises. Trees across driveways, even though it's not even within property boundaries, I'm sure we did a fair bit of work that was really outside our normal activities, and probably if our insurers were on hand, they would have been tut-tutting, but it's something we felt we needed to do, and I think we did pretty well. Once we sort of started getting on top of the immediate access issues, there was a lot of work to be done around people where the SES had been able to respond. A big tree had fallen on a house, and the SES might have been able to come in and secure the premises, maybe tarped up the house, but then those sorts of people were probably looking for some answers as to how they were going to get the tree off their house, who was going to pay for it, where did the tree come from, who was responsible. Given that we own a lot of parkland around the city, we knew we'd have a lot of trees to be responsible for, and there was a massive concentration on trying to work out where our trees had caused problems and get those trees out of people's way so that emergency repairs to homes could be undertaken, some longer-term solutions start to be implemented by the owners. One thing that was a slight distraction that we didn't expect at that time is that people started, particularly on the Sunday, to get out to try and start using the cycleways again, the footpaths, and it wasn't an obvious priority to us, but then if people were going to be climbing over and around trees on, for example, the Warners Bay cycleway, we obviously needed to divert some people to go and clean it up to avoid the risks to them that would, no doubt, we would then become responsible for if they'd hurt themselves. It's kind of, it's interesting in a way that people are resilient enough living without electricity and in some cases running water, because there were plenty of pumps, and Hunter Water had lots of issues with keeping water supply going, that people were still prepared to go out and have a walk around the cycle path at Warners Bay. So we were able to get the cycleway open fairly quickly, and probably a lot sooner than we would otherwise have expected to try and do it, to try and open. In fact, on the Sunday morning, I had to go down to Warners Bay for some reason or other in the morning, and I can recall seeing this family trying to have a picnic at one of our picnic tables, completely surrounded by all the litter that had washed up out of the lake and fallen trees, and anyway, showed great dedication to having a picnic in one of our parks. Once we got the customer service centre up and running, we had to invent some new systems, which the people on the ground in the customer service centre readily took care of. They sort of really organised themselves very well, made sure they were able to triage requests and concerns as they came in. They were able to bring Silver Lake staff into the customer service centre, which isn't our normal way of operating, but that helped a lot with coordinating responses. We then started to have problems emerging with landslips on private land and in some cases public land, which once again isn't something we normally have to deal with. The SES had evacuated people in a couple of locations, and the police in fact had also evacuated people, which is a more serious step in that once the police evacuated you're not allowed to go back to your property. As of today, which is the 20th of September, was it July, August, September, 3 months after the storm, there are still three families in the city who can't return to their homes because of landslip erosion problems that we're still working on. Two at Rankin Park and one at Cardiff. On the Monday, things were response was sort of ramping up a bit, and the state government would recognise very quickly the scale of the problem that they were dealing with locally, and had dispatched the as well as a bunch of ministers, the Director General of the Department of Premier and Cabinet to Newcastle, had organised a meeting quickly with all the available mayors and general managers. Given our general manager was still flooded in, I went to that meeting in at City Hall, and a disaster recovery strategy was thrashed out reasonably quickly, within a matter of a couple of hours. Oh, sorry, Robin Cruck is the name of the woman, by the way, from Director General Department of Premiers and Cabinet, who coordinated the response. The Premier attended, of course, and expressed his good wishes to everyone and showed his concern. As a result of that meeting, a committee was set up to be known as the Hunter Disaster Recovery Committee. It has a certain statutory basis, which I don't fully understand, but the committee has powers to organise and coordinate the response to the disaster. And given the availability of general managers, I was elected or appointed or anointed as the local government representative on that committee. What became a pretty onerous task of representing all local government's interests back to this committee across the region. So suddenly we were not only dealing with Lake Macquarie's problems, but also acting as a conduit for issues in places like Upper Hunter Council, Singleton, who had a levee bank problem, Port Stephens Council, who felt left out of the Pashabalka recovery, and of course the Pashabalka had broken up, the oil spills would have been on their beaches, and in any case, there are a lot of issues across the region. So in our own efforts at that time, we were concentrating on how we would respond, what sort of service we'd provide to our ratepayers, customers, and it was decided that we really needed to broaden and ramp up our normal curbside clean-up activities. So in a normal year, we'd twice a year get to every residential property in the city and take away sort of bulky waste items that they'd leave on the footpath. In this instance, we knew lots of people had damaged household goods. Carpets had been ruined by water, furniture. Of course, bits of the house had been damaged by falling trees and water inundation. And on top of that, we had absolutely masses and masses of green waste, tree limbs and whole trees that had come down around the city on private land that people really needed some sort of assistance to get rid of. So we mobilised pretty well everything that we could from our own resources to start cleaning up around off the footpath whatever people were putting out. This time we had a bit of an issue with the insurance companies. Insurance companies, in the first instance, were telling people that they couldn't dispose of damaged household items until insurance assessors had been around to tick off that these goods existed and that they were able to appraise them and confirm that they'd get a payout, the owners would get a payout. That was probably pretty reasonable for the first few days, but then, of course, after a while, some insurance companies were being a bit more lenient. It's putting pressure on those that weren't prepared to let their customers dispose of their goods. Anyone that's lived with a wet carpet for more than a few days probably appreciates that you really want to get rid of it as soon as you can, because if you can't get the carpet out, then you start having effect on your flooring and skirting boards and even your walls. So eventually this was something the Disaster Recovery Committee was able to work with the Insurance Council of Australia on, and there was agreement across the region that all insurers would allow people to dispose of all their damaged household goods immediately, just take photographs of it in situ and then get it out onto the footpath. There were some issues with different councils wanting to take a different approach to putting goods out. Newcastle Council, for example, wanted people to store all their stuff behind the fence line so it didn't interfere with their footpaths, and we were trying to get the message out. We just wanted it out on the footpath so that we could more easily come and pick it up. We were trying to make our collections with backhoes and so forth rather than with people picking the material up and throwing it in the back of a truck. Anyway, those sorts of things did eventually get sorted out, and we sort of agreed that the inconvenience of having stuff on the footpath was outweighed by the need to efficiently get rid of this stuff. We were using our open-top trucks, which we wouldn't normally use for this sort of service, and as many backhoes as we could get. We had offers from different places for assistance. Centennial Coal had crew which they'd brought in to clean up their own sites, and then they still had them available for a period and lent them to us, and were able to put them to work near one of their sites, so they got some kudos from their immediate neighbours for the clean-up that they did. We did talk at one stage about trying to mobilise armed forces because the main issue was simply having enough trucks and plant and operators to pick up all the material that was appearing. And we sort of chased that for a week or so, but in the end it became too difficult. The army just didn't have the sort of equipment that was most needed. And they probably would have ended up, if they tried to use the equipment they did have, doing more harm to our roads and footpaths and so forth than they would have contributed in assistance. Some of the councils in the Upper Hunter that weren't as badly affected with the wind and the floods would have probably assisted more if they could at the time, but because of the flooding around the Lower Hunter, they really couldn't access us. One of the best offers we got was from Baulkham Hills Council, a Sydney council, who sent two crews up here and worked with us for 2 weeks and built a great bridge, I think, between our council and Baulkham Hills Council. Their contribution was much appreciated and was recognised by the Mayor and the General Manager visiting them quite recently to present certificates. I think Randwick Council came and assisted Newcastle City for a few days as well. I think it was in a small part a public relations exercise for those organisations, but it was also much appreciated by us because it wasn't that we didn't have the money to pay people to come and do the work, we just didn't have the people and the plant to get the job done. So that was sort of the clean-up under control. The next issues sort of that emerged were revolving around things like how we were going to get pay for the damage. By the declaration of a natural disaster by the state government, we were able to access natural disaster relief funds, which are organised nationally and effectively are ultimately funded by the federal government. The state government, in consultation, declares the disaster. We then are able to access funds which they draw down from the federal government in turn. There are a lot of rules around what you can claim and what you can't claim and what the amounts for individual items can be. But certainly in the early days, the state government and the federal government were very keen to make sure that there was no limitation on the sort of funding that was going to flow to the region. About that time, I think our estimates were around sort of the $12 and $13 million mark. As of today, they're up to about $19 million in terms of costs that proposed to expend in cleaning up and repairing storm damage. And to this point, although we haven't started receiving checks, we're very confident that we're going to be looked after quite reasonably by the state and federal government in those arrangements.